Thanks for coming along to the Gallipoli Club tonight to hear David Horner make his first appearance at the Sydney Institute. And he's well known to many of you, but I will introduce him. He's Professor Horner is Professor of Australian Defence History in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre of the Australian National University in Canberra. He's a graduate of the Royal Military College Duntroon. He served as an infantry patrol commander in South Vietnam. David Horner is the editor of 32 books on military command, operations, defence policy and intelligence, and in 2004 he was appointed official historian of the Australian peacekeeping, humanitarian and post-Cold War operations, and is joint author of two of the volumes in that series. But David Horner is here tonight to discuss his most recent book, The Spy Catchers, The Official History of ASIO, 1949 to 1963, which is the first in a three-part, I think, series. So welcome to Professor Horner, talking on the topic tonight at the Sydney Institute, telling the secrets, writing the official history of ASIO. David Horner, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction, and it's a great pleasure to be here this evening. In November 1986, just over 28 years ago, a court case took place in Sydney in which the British government sought to prevent the publication of a book with a similar name to mine, namely Spy Catcher, by a former MI5 officer, Peter Wright. At one stage in the court case, Sir Robert Armstrong, Secretary of the British War Cabinet, admitted that Sir Dick White had been chief of the British Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. Pressed by Wright's 32-year-old lawyer, Malcolm Turnbull, Armstrong acknowledged that MI6 existed when White was head of it, but he could not admit that MI6 had existed before then or after then. Well then, things have certainly changed since those times with regard to talking and writing about intelligence organisations. But the whole idea of publishing a history of an intelligence organisation based on its classified files seems counterintuitive. Intelligence services trade in secrecy. If they reveal their sources, the sources will dry up. If they reveal their techniques, their opponents will counter them. If the identities of officers are revealed, they will no longer be able to operate with the freedom that is necessary to achieve their tasks. Nevertheless, the appearance of histories of Britain's MI5 in 2009 and MI6 in 2010 seemed to set a precedent for an intelligence service publishing its own history. Beyond this precedent, however, there are very good reasons for publishing a history of the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, ASIO. Through a series of historical and political circumstances, many myths or half-truths have flourished about the early decades of the organisation. Indeed, these myths have continued through to the present. In August last year, the author of a new book about ASIO wrote a newspaper article that was syndicated around Australia. The author began with the statement that since its creation in 1949, ASIO's Directors General have not had their names published, let alone have addressed the National Press Club. This, of course, is another myth. Rather, every Director General since the first one, Geoffrey Reid, have had their names published. Charles Spry, the Director General from 1950 to 1970, had his picture splashed across the front pages of newspapers during the Petrov Royal Commission. One Director General, Harvey Barnett, wrote a book about his experiences. Previous Directors General have certainly addressed the press club. The perpetuation of these myths have damaged the organisation's standing in the Australian community, and this is unfortunate because ASIO does not exist for itself. Rather, ASIO exists to serve the nation. As a government instrumentality, it ultimately needs to justify its existence to the people of Australia and both sides of Parliament and to retain their confidence. my history, based on full and unrestricted access to ASIO's records, seeks to dispel many of the myths about it. This particular volume explains why ASIO was formed in 1949, describes ASIO's role in the defection of the Petrovs in 1954, and ends with the expulsion of Ivan Skripov in 1963. It also describes many other activities that have never before been revealed. I chose the title of my volume, The Spy Catchers, for three reasons. First, this is a history of the organisation. It's not about Soviet espionage in Australia, the Communist Party of Australia, the Cold War, or ASIO's effect on particular groups in the community, although all of these appear prominently in the story. The focus is on the organisation, how it dealt with certain challenges, how it changed over time, how it achieved its successes, and how at times there were shortcomings in its performance. Second, the title is a reminder that ASIO was set up to catch spies. Evidence of Soviet espionage in the 1940s was damaging Australia's national security and its relationship with its allies. ASIO's prime role was counter-espionage, to deal with the immediate problem and to counter the threat in the following years. Now, closely allied with this role, ASIO was charged with counter-subversion. In simple terms, subversion is an activity aimed at overthrowing or undermining the legitimately elected government of Australia by non-democratic means. In the 1950s, it was undertaken by certain members of the Communist Party who rejected the accepted democratic process. Now, since ASIO had evidence that members of the Communist Party had engaged in espionage on behalf of the Soviet Union, it followed that a prudent precaution was to remove the members of the Communist Party from jobs where they might have access to sensitive information about national security. Hence, ASIO was involved in vetting people for security clearance. But this major task was a byproduct of its prime role, namely counter-espionage. And the third reason for the title is that it reflects the fact that the book is about ASIO's people. ASIO's officers were and are normal, dedicated Australians. In the 1950s, they believed that they were doing a job that was vital to the security of the nation. I wanted to bring them out of the shadows and recognise their efforts. And I'm going to elaborate on some of these issues a bit later. But first, I want to describe how the project began and how we went about our task. In 2008, the Commonwealth Attorney General approved the writing of an official history of ASIO, and the organisation advertised for authors or institutions to research and write it. Now, in this context, an official history is not the organisation's view of its history. Rather, it is a history written by an independent historian for an organisation and based primarily on the organisation's own records. And several universities submitted tenders for the job. The Australian National University, the ANU, was successful, and the project began formally in August 2009. As the principal author, I was adamant that we would not accept any direction from ASIO as to how we would tell the story. And we would write the history as we saw it, based on ASIO's records. To achieve this aim, we would need complete and unrestricted access to all ASIO records relevant to the period we were researching. And I'm pleased to say that ASIO kept its part of the bargain. We were not denied access to the files we asked for, to any files we asked for. And indeed, we found files that ASIO did not even know that they had. Naturally, there are some aspects of the story which we have not been able to publish for reasons of national security. But surprisingly, few of these matters have been deleted from the volume. Now, although it's illegal under the ASIO Act to release the names of ASIO officers, we were keen to identify as many of them as possible. And you can see a bit of the ASIO Act there on the screen. When we interviewed former ASIO officers, we asked them to agree to have their names revealed. Most did so. We were then able to seek permission from the Director General of Security to release the names. Also, we wanted to make sure that if we encountered any problem, we could appeal to a semi-outside body. ASIO therefore established a History Advisory Committee. It was chaired by the Director General and included one of his deputies. But it also included two outsiders, Professor Jeff Gallop, a former Labor Premier of Western Australia, and Jim Carlton, a former minister in the Fraser Coalition Government. This committee did not seek to give any direction to the writing, but it provided valuable advice. We believed that it was important to engage with the views and arguments about ASIO that appeared in the numerous books and articles over the past three decades, including many dealing with ASIO's treatment of individuals or groups in the community. On the other hand, conscious that our task was to tell the story of the organisation, I decided that rather than beginning with these files on individuals, I should start by examining ASIO's policy files so that we had a broad picture of the organisation's activities. And I found a more complex and multifaceted story than we previously recognised. While some widely published issues seemed less important when viewed from within ASIO. For example, whereas some journal articles and books had suggested that ASIO's surveillance of writers and artists required closer examination, I found that it was just a relatively small part of ASIO's activities. I just did not have the time and space to deal with those issues in any great depth. So primarily, this history is based on ASIO's official records. And for this volume alone, we have accessed 1,900 files, and most of those files have multiple parts. They're the ones we accessed in ASIO. Then we accessed numerous ASIO and other departmental files at the National Archives. The project could not have been undertaken, let alone completed, without the outstanding work of our research officer, Dr. Rhys Crawley. And as well, The Spy Catchers is the first of a three-volume series, and to assist with the writing task, we were joined by Dr. John Blaxland, who had previously served as an intelligence officer in the Australian Army. And the series is shown there on the screen. Dr. Blaxland is the author of Volume 2, and he and Dr. Crawley are writing Volume 3. And it goes up to 1989, which is effectively the end of the Cold War. And I'm pleased to report that Volume 2 is now going to the publishers after being cleared, and we hope that it will appear at the end of this year. We expect to have a draft of Volume 3 completed by the middle of this year. It too will then need to be cleared for publication. I now want to turn to some of the themes of the book. The first theme is the importance of signals intelligence. In the mid and the late 1940s, American and British crypt analysts deciphered the encrypted cabled messages between the headquarters of the Soviet Intelligence Service, the KGB, and its resident intelligence officers in embassies around the world. This Venona intelligence, as it was known, revealed the existence of a spy ring in Australia, and ASIO was then set up to try to catch the spies. The Venona program was extremely secret, and over the succeeding years, ASIO spent much effort in trying to protect knowledge of Venona's existence. Another major theme is the role of Britain's security service, MI5, in establishing and fostering ASIO in 1949. The first heads of ASIO were determined to ensure that ASIO became an independent Australian security service, even though they relied heavily on advice from MI5. Soon, ASIO learned to stand on its own feet, and my volume describes how at first ASIO relied on MI5, then how it developed its own worldwide network of contacts. It's impossible to understand the early history of ASIO without appreciating the political and social climate of the early Cold War period. Australians who had lived through the Second World War when the threat of invasion seemed frighteningly real were determined to confront and defeat what they perceived as a new and equally dangerous threat, Thus, in the 1950s, with the Cold War between the Communist bloc and the West at its height, ASIO's officers saw themselves as frontline warriors in a war against a twofold enemy, the Soviet Union and the Communist Party of Australia, the CPA. With regard to the Soviet Union, ASIO saw its main task as ensuring that Soviet intelligence officers operating under diplomatic cover were unable to conduct espionage in Australia. As for the CPA, ASIO first had to ensure that its members and sympathisers were excluded from positions where they might have access to sensitive information. ASIO therefore needed to establish a comprehensive list of CPA members and also to develop procedures for vetting people who might need access to sensitive information, and therefore vetting became a major ASIO preoccupation. Next, ASIO needed to deal with the threat of subversion. ASIO and the government believed that the CPA, on behalf of the Soviet Union, was engaged in a concerted campaign to undermine the public's confidence in the Australian democratic system and ultimately to overthrow it. Based on the statements of CPA officials, this was a reasonable assessment, although some would challenge whether the CPA's capability would ever be likely to match this intent. The coalition government, led by Prime Minister Robert Menzies, hoped to deal with this threat through legislative means, such as banning the CPA, but that did not prove possible. Meanwhile, ASIO sought through a range of measures, including covert surveillance and infiltration, to gain a comprehensive picture of the CPA's membership and activities. It also focused on front organisations, that is, organisations that had been covertly set up by the CPA or were controlled by the CPA. The manner in which ASIO allegedly spied on innocent Australians and produced voluminous dossiers on them to find out if they were CPA members or sympathisers is an enduring theme in ASIO's history and the focus of much of the criticism of the organisation. Some of the moral dilemmas faced by ASIO officers were caused by the fact that for much of the period covered by my book, ASIO operated without a legislative framework. When ASIO was established, Prime Minister Ben Chifley issued the new Director General of Security, Justice Geoffrey Reid, with a charter in which he was charged with the defence of the Commonwealth from external and internal dangers arising from attempts at espionage and sabotage, or from actions of persons and organisations which may be subversive of the security of the Commonwealth. Reid wasn't told how he was to fulfil this mandate, except he needed to be satisfied that an important public interest bearing on the defence of the Commonwealth is at stake. So when Reid decided he needed to intercept telephone conversations of selected individuals, Chifley verbally approved the phone taps and there was no written approval. When Charles Bryce succeeded Reid in July 1950, he received a similar charter and he continued the phone taps. Nonetheless, Reid and Spry understood clearly that ASIO's role was to collect intelligence and advise the government. ASIO had no executive function, that is, unlike the police, it could not apprehend and arrest people. In the meantime, ASIO's most noteworthy activity was the successful management of the defection of the Soviet intelligence officer Vladimir Petrov and his wife Evdokia. That was in April 1954. As Sir Charles Spry commented, the defection gave ASIO world-class standing amongst the democratic world intelligence communities. It strengthened immensely our liaison with them. The story of the ensuing Royal Commission on Espionage, however, is much more complex, and its outcome had long-term implications for Australia and ASIO. The imprudent response by the leader of the opposition, Dr. Bert Evatt, exacerbated tensions in the Australian Labor Party, which contributed to the split of the party and the formation of the Democratic Labor Party, the DLP. In subsequent federal elections, the DLP directed its preferences away from the ALP and thereby kept the coalition in power for the next 17 years. The misfortune for ASIO was that Evatt accused it of manufacturing the Petrov defection to assist the election of the Menzies coalition government. And he even alleged that ASIO officers falsified documents in order to link his staff with Soviet espionage. These intemperate and untrue charges by Evatt poisoned the relationship between ASIO and the ALP for the next two decades. People in the community accepted the ALP's assertion that ASIO and the organisation's reputation, assertions about ASIO, and hence the organisation's reputation was damaged. Some people still believe these false assertions. With ASIO under attack from the alternative government, Spry was concerned about the survival of his organisation. And as a result of his initiative, in December 1956, the government passed the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation Act 1956, which for the first time publicly specified the functions of the organisation. In 1960, the government amended the Crimes Act to spell out what was meant by treason, treachery and sabotage. Also that year, the government passed the Telephonic Communications Interception Act, which specified the conditions under which ASIO could intercept telephone conversations. These acts helped articulate ASIO's lawful parameters. The legislative cover for many of ASIO's activities, however, still remained unclear. For example, in the late 1950s, ASIO carried out disruptive spoiling operations against the CPA. ASIO's officers, agents or contacts also wrote articles exposing CPA activities for publication in newspapers and magazines. These actions did not seem to fit the functions specified in the ASIO Act. I now want to give a few glimpses of the history as it appears in this first volume. ASIO's first task, when it was established in 1949, was to investigate a spy ring that had been identified by the Venona program. And you'll recall that this program involved the intercept and deciphering of communications of the Soviet intelligence service, that is, the KGB. The details of this spy ring were first described in detail in a 1998 book called Breaking the Codes, which I co-authored with my ANU colleague, Professor Desmond Ball. ASIO simply called this investigation task the case. The Soviets used cover names to describe their officers and the Australians who were assisting them. The central figure was an official of the Australian Communist Party, Wally Clayton, who was given the cover name Clod. Two other important personalities were Ian Milner, cover name Burr, and Jim Hill, cover name Tourist, who worked in the Department of External Affairs, now Foreign Affairs. They gave classified information to Clayton, who passed it to Semyon Makarov, the KGB resident in the Soviet embassy, and also to Fedor Nosov, the TASS correspondent, who also passed it to the Soviet embassy. Another key personality was Francis Burney, cover name Sestra, who worked in the office of the Minister for External Affairs, none other than Doc Evatt, and she passed the information to Clayton. Now, this story has been previously told, but I've been able to add some more detail. The experience of Len Helig, an ASIO officer who kept watch over Clayton's house at Mossman, gives some idea of the conditions endured by those conducting surveillance, as well as a glimpse of ASIO's operating methods at the time. Aged 28, Helig had served in the army during the Second World War. He joined ASIO's Brisbane office in June 1949. The following month, he was brought to Sydney and accommodated in a boarding house 3 kilometres from Clayton's residence in Mossman. He was instructed to observe the house from 6:30 a.m. until all lights were extinguished, which invariably was never before 1 a.m. If Helig observed Clayton or any of his visitors leaving by vehicle, he was to phone Bob Wake, the deputy head of ASIO who was running the case. And Wake would arrange to have Clayton's car followed as it crossed Sydney Harbour Bridge. Now, the only suitable vantage point from which to observe Clayton's house was a rocky outcrop jutting out into the harbour at the bottom of Clayton's Street. So Heerlig obtained a fishing line and dangled it in the water. Now, this was pleasant enough in fine weather, but in bleak, rainy weather in midwinter, it was a little incongruous. At night, and in poor light conditions, Heerlig moved to a bus shelter near Clayton's house. It was during the height of the 1949 coal strike, and parts of Sydney were frequently blacked out. And with an upsurge in crime, police stepped up their patrols, and at times Heerlig had to explain that he was waiting for his girlfriend. Because Heerlig was from Brisbane, he should have been paid by that office. But this was not possible because he was in Sydney. Of course, there was no electronic transfer of funds in those days. So when he ran out of money, he would phone Wake. An old Morris car would then drive past, and Wake would throw out a rolled-up newspaper in which Heerlig would retrieve and hopefully, inside, find his fortnightly pay packet. Meals, of course, were another problem. There were no eating houses in the area, and in any case, there was no one to relieve him. Heerlig's diet consisted of Devon sausage and packets of potato crisps, which was about all he could obtain from the only shop in the area. So after nearly 5 weeks on this enforced diet, combined with an average of 3 hours sleep per night and a touch of pleurisy due to continually wet clothing, Heerlig, who had prided himself on being fairly fit, went back to Brisbane 10 kilograms lighter. He arrived home, feeling relieved that the observation stint was over. But that evening the phone rang. It was Wake, instructing him to return to Sydney and to commence surveillance of Fedor Nosov. Now, the episode shows the devotion of ASIO officers in trying to complete tasks that they were led to believe were vitally important to the security of Australia. Len Heerlig went on to a long and distinguished career in ASIO. At one stage, he helped look after the Petrovs and when they were in their safe house during the Royal Commission on Espionage. In the book, I spend a bit of time explaining how ASIO recruited and ran its agents who reported on the activities of the Communist Party and front organisations. Agents are not the same as ASIO officers. ASIO officers are full-time employees of the organisation. By contrast, ASIO agents work in the community at their day jobs, but under direction from ASIO, they report on what they've seen and heard. The names of ASIO agents are never revealed. However, some have become known, usually because they have revealed their work themselves. One well-known ASIO agent, Michael Bieliguski, who gained the trust of Vladimir Petrov and persuaded him to defect. A lesser-known agent was Anne Neal. She worked as a typist for Elliot Johnson, Secretary of the South Australian Peace Council, who was also a member of the Central Committee and the South Australian State Committee of the Communist Party. Anne Neal became a secret member of the Communist Party and passed a mass of reports and copies of documents to her ASIO handler. In December 1952, she attended the Third World Peace Congress in Vienna and then took up an invitation to return via Moscow and Peking. According to legend, she became the first Allied agent to be invited behind the Iron Curtain. She retired from the Communist Party resigned from the Communist Party in 1958 and went public about her role as a spy in December 1961. The story of the expulsion of the Soviet diplomat and intelligence officer Ivan Skripov in February 1963 is reasonably well known, but we've been able to provide some more details. Skripov recruited a British-born woman, Kay Marshall, and groomed her to deliver messages to illegal Soviet agents. Actually, she was an ASIO double agent. My final glimpse of the ASIO story is about the bugging of the headquarters of the Victorian branch of the Communist Party. The target was the office of Ted Hill, secretary of the Victorian branch of the CPA. Ted Hill was the brother of Jim Hill, who, according to the Venona intercepts, had passed external affairs documents to the Soviet Union. Ted Hill's office was on the ninth floor of a building in Elizabeth Street, Melbourne. Between November 1952 and August 1953, ASIO officers bugged Hill's office with a microphone and entered his office to photograph documents and check the microphones. ASIO temporarily halted the operation when CPA officials became more security conscious. In October 1956, ASIO tried another approach. They leased an office on the 8th floor, just below the CPA premises. They established a listening post there. ASIO officers then installed another microphone in Hill's office. The cable from the microphone was dropped down the wall cavity and connected to the equipment in the listening post, and the technicians ensured that the length of the cable from the microphone was twice the length necessary to reach the 8th floor, so that if it was discovered, it would give the impression that it was from the 7th floor. Two ASIO officers, a husband and a wife team, who had recently arrived from England and were not known in Melbourne, opened a dummy market research business on the 8th floor. The husband operated primarily as the front man for the firm, while his wife listened to the conversations in Hill's office and produced reports from the raw product. And the intelligence gained from this operation was very high quality. But ASIO succumbed to the temptation to use it in a spoiler-type operation. There was a significant Communist Party crisis in mid-1958 over the expulsion of a well-known member of who was a university lecturer, and ASIO floated the story to the Melbourne Herald newspaper. But after an investigation among party members, Hill concluded that few people knew about the events described, so he enlisted the assistance of a CPA technician, Harry Stanistreet, who was employed by the Postmaster General's Department. Stanistreet successfully located the microphone on the 20th of January 1959. The ASIO office in the floor below, listening to the proceedings, realised that the line had gone dead, and she had the presence of mind to disconnect the cable attached to the audio equipment and to drop the end of the cable down the wall cavity. Stanistreet pulled up the cable, measured it, calculated that the listening post was 2 floors down. He went down to the 7th floor where there was a firm of investigators and accused them of being connected with ASIO. ASIO maintained the bogus market research firm for a few months before it was quietly closed. The Communist Party publicised the incident widely, naming the firm of investigators in its newspaper Tribune. The Communist Party state president also wrote the Prime Minister, Menzies, protesting at the installation of a microphone in their offices and demanding that those responsible be punished and ASIO be disbanded. Spry advised Menzies that the microphone had been installed because ASIO had every reason to believe that Edward Fowler Hill, in whose room it was discovered, was engaged in work for the illegal apparatus of the Communist Party of Australia and probably in espionage on behalf of the Soviet Union. No evidence was ever produced to prove this data claim. Well, these are just a few glimpses of the stories in our book. Many of the stories have never been told before. However, I accept that some of the stories in the book have previously appeared in other books and articles. That was always going to be inevitable with this story. But at least readers can be confident that what I've told is correct as far as ASIO's records are correct. So I'd now be very happy to answer any questions that you might have, noting that I have no knowledge about current ASIO operations.
Many thanks to David Horner. Janet Grundy's got some copies of The Spy Catchers, The Official History of ASIO, 1949 to 1963, which I'm sure Professor Horner would be happy to sign after the talk. And so we come to questions and discussion. We started off early on with some reference to some of the kind of irrational and unfair criticism of ASIO in the 1950s. And you mentioned Bert Everett, the then leader of the Labour Party, who I think it's fair to say whose mental health has now been seriously assessed with respect to that time. But I think it's true that there was a man who was kicked out of ASIO around 1950 called Robert Wake, who, a disillusioned person, seemed to feed Everett a lot of the false material that he used against ASIO, and Wake himself seemed to be obsessed with this kind of Britain, United States, Vatican access, and was subsumed with a sort of form of anti-Catholic sectarianism. What do you think played into it? If you look at Evatt's papers in the Flinders Library for this period, they are very erratic. They've got all this conspiratorial, almost crazy stuff coming into him. And how do you, from your reading of ASIO's assessment of what was going on, what do you think was motivating Evatt? Was he being provoked, or was he looking for people to provoke him?
Well, there is no doubt that Evatt came to this conclusion early in the piece of as a result of his own pondering. You can read it about in the book about the fact that several members of his staff had been passing information to Lockwood, who'd been writing up reports that, in the Soviet embassy, and this was in this material came to light in the Royal Commission. Evatt saw this as evidence of a conspiracy against him. But as, with regard to Bob Wake, there's a lot of stuff out there being published about Bob Wake, with the sort of impression being given that Wake was being persecuted by ASIO for some reason or other. You know, they're watching him. Well, we've been able to show in the book that...
That's a ship passing.
Oh, a ship passing. Oh,
okay.
ASIO, we've been able to show that, in fact, that's not how it worked at all. ASIO was trying to find these illegal agents, and they settled on a man by the name of Brezniak, whose name had come up in the papers brought out by Brezniak. So by Petrov. So they tapped Brezniak's phone, and who did they find? His great mate, the man he kept talking to, but it was none other than Alan Dalziel, who was Evatt's private secretary. And then it goes on, but who's Dalziel's girlfriend at that time? None other than the woman who had been involved with Petrov back earlier. And then they found that they were meeting, this group was meeting in Evatt's offices. And who should be there advising them about how bad ASIO was, but none other than Bob Wake, who'd previously worked in ASIO. And it's at that point that ASIO start to watch Bob Wake, and it's at this point also that that Wake is passing this information through to Evatt. Evatt, of course, is a very is very keen to get this information, because all it does is confirms the view that he had already come to, that there was a conspiracy.
Said it. You said it. Yeah. Okay. There's a question, John. Yes. Let's stand in front of the camera. Okay. Yeah.
Professor, thank you very much. I suspect that in those archives, of course, you've got enough material to write a fairly racing television series along the Game of Thrones of ASIO. 4 years ago, at the back of us here, at the wonderful old Colonial Magistrates building here, there was an exhibition at the Police and Justice Museum called Persons of Interest. Mm. And a cursory walk through there seemed to show that ASIO, in the period that you're talking of, as well as catching spies, was obsessed with monitoring people who objected to government policy as well. Justice Michael Kirby, as he's now called, was one of those who was filmed by ASIO.
John McGuinness.
And I remember a little conversation with a 17-year-old ringing his mother and saying he passed his driving test. Do you believe that I know you don't want to comment on policy or knowledge of it, do you believe that contemporary ASIO, in these straitened budget times, has more pressing matters to attend to than people trying to object to government policy?
Well, I think the real question is the historical question about the alleged improper surveillance by ASIO at the time of the 50s and 60s of people like Michael Kirby.
Remember that the book that the one we're talking about finishes in 1963. So the surveillance is taking place in the 1950s, and the real focus of ASIO's surveillance is firstly the CPA. They need to find out who's in the CPA. Then they go one step beyond that, front organisations, and then they go to the people who are involved in the front organisations, who might not necessarily be CPA members, but they need to be watched to see if there's any evidence that they are. And I describe in the book how this was a huge waste of ASIO's resources. Now, just because ASIO is watching a person and raises a file on them doesn't necessarily mean they've done anything wrong, but it was a huge waste of resources. ASIO had every right to try to work out who's a member of the CPA so they could be vetted, so you don't get into public service. But how far down the chain do you need to go in chasing people? And I think that ASIO sort of lost sight of this along the way. And there are many reasons for this, but one of them, of course, is that they'd been partly backed into a corner by the fact that they were being attacked every which way they turned by the Labor Party in Parliament because of this business with the Petrov Royal Commission. But yes, I do spell out this in the book, and I say that I think that they were lost sight of what they should have been doing at that time.
Stuart Clark.
Thank you, Professor. I say I enjoyed reading the book. It's a fascinating history and a fascinating part of Australia's past. One of the things he touched upon was not only briefly was the potential Soviet penetration of Asia in the early days. So you correct my remark by saying I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but if you go back to Sir Roger Hollis, the people have made suggestions, albeit dismissed, that he may have been active from the other side. The history of what happened in the UK was the level of penetration in the US. Then you fast forward to the yet-to-be-revealed discussions in relation to potential Soviet penetration of ASIO in more recent history. And you have that big gap between Petrov and Skripov, and then on the face of it, not much in common. Do you have a view in relation to the potential for Soviet penetration and the likelihood of it? And do you think that that's something which is yet to be finalised, or do you think it's a...
Okay, so there's a question about potential or real Soviet Union penetration of ASIO.
I'm not able to talk about anything beyond the end of 1963. You'll just have to wait for those volumes to come out. The deal, of course, with ASIO is we had full access, but we can't talk about what access we had until it's published. But I talked about penetration in my volume, and I concluded that there was probably not any substantial penetration of ASIO in the period that we're talking about. I do talk about some minor incidents, some perhaps the CPA trying to penetrate ASIO for a different reason, otherwise to get themselves tipped off. But I don't believe that the Soviet Union was able to properly penetrate ASIO in the period that I'm talking about. And we were very aware of that, and we dragged out every file we could find to find anything out about that.
Peter Coleman.
Thank you. May I add to the others how much I've enjoyed the book? My question deals with the Coral Bell case. Shortly before, a few months before the book came out, your collaborator in Breaking the Code Protein Coral Bell, now a very famous celebrated international relations scholar, probing her about attempts to recruit her as a Soviet agent when she was a diplomatic cadet. And I thought that was a really interesting report from a very good source, Protein her. You want me to wind up?
Yep. Sorry. Well, finish your question.
So I was looking forward to your book to see what you had to say about it.
I've got to make sure everything's picked up in the microphone. So there's a question about the late Coral Bell's comments shortly before she died about an attempt to recruit her to become a Soviet agent.
In fact, it's a bit broader than that because there are accusations made by Professor Des Ball with Burton.
John
Burton, Secretary of External Affairs, article in Quadrant about 2 years ago on that. What I decided to do was to tell the story as it appears in ASIO's records. It's not a story about espionage, it's a story about ASIO. And I didn't see it as our role in telling the story to speculate, and that's what these things most speculate on who or who might not have been a spy, but what I would hope is that our book at least provides a starting point for others who might like to do that.
Okay, so there's a question here. We've got to be brief, okay?
Mary, I know you're starting a bit later than what I want to talk about, but Dr. Evan is involved. As I understand it, Dr. Evan in 42 asked Sir Roden Cutler to set up a security service. Was the staff from that used further on in Asia? And if they were, the second person to run that organisation was Jesse Street, who was a known communist.
The suggestion is that some of the people who ended up in ASIO started off in intelligence in the 1940s, and was Jesse Street ever a possibility?
Well, the short answer is no. The security service from the Second World War, and there are several security services in the Second World War, after the war became the Commonwealth Investigation Service, and it was because of shortcomings in the Commonwealth Investigation Service that ASIO was set up. When ASIO was set up, it drew some members of their staff, selected ones, from the Commonwealth Investigation Service, some from police special branches around Australia, some out of the services, and we should not be surprised at that when we remember that a million people served in services in Australia in the Second World War, so there's nothing remarkable about that. So ASIO was set up as a new organisation, and tried to be very careful to make sure that anybody from those previous organisations over which there might have been some doubt did not get into ASIO. For example, Alfred Hughes, who served in the security service during the 1940s, tried to get into ASIO but was stopped. ASIO believed that he was one of the agents working for the Soviet Union.
Yes, Chris down there. And then there. Yep.
Was there any evidence that the attitudes exemplified in the United States and by Senator McCarthy and others affected the mental processes of ASIO in the 1940s?
Was there any influence of McCarthyism-style activities within Australia?
A lot of it's cheap throwaway lines in books and articles saying that, you know, what was going on in Australia in the early 1950s was like the McCarthy witch hunt in the McCarthy in the United States, McCarthyism. I don't believe that is the case. And you've got to remember the general environment of the Cold War and a belief that the Soviet Union was going to be, or if it wasn't already, the enemy. The Communist Party is on the side of the Soviet Union. That was a view that people in Australia came to and didn't need to be influenced by McCarthyism to come to that view in Australia. And I do spell out that a little bit in the book about what was going on in Australia was a bit different from what was going on in the United States.
Question there? Yes.
Is there any evidence that there were some files that were so sensitive that they had to be destroyed? Do you think all the files have been
destroyed?
Were some files so sensitive that they had to be destroyed?
There is no doubt that there have been files destroyed in ASIO along the way for all sorts of reasons. Some of them nefarious and some of them just plain silly. At one stage, I just can't remember the details of this, under one of the more recent governments, I mean recent in the last 30 years, a lot of files on politicians were destroyed, and that's a great shame because if we'd seen those, we probably would have got a better view about what ASIO was doing with politicians. But I'm very confident that there was no case of us wanting a file and then the file was destroyed. We're talking about files that were destroyed quite a long time ago.
There's a question there. Yes.
Can you expand on the relationship on the material you found in ASIO versus what you found in the National Archives?
So the question is, what's in ASIO's files, what's in the National Archives files?
Yeah, there are different sorts of files in the National Archives. We were able to get access to records of the Attorney General's Department, Prime Minister and Cabinet, Department of Defence, Foreign Affairs and Trade, through the good offices of the secretaries of those departments. So that is obviously broadening the story beyond ASIO. ASIO has been putting records into the archives for many years, and a lot of them are completely open. You can go and have a look at them, have a look at them on the internet. Some of them have been redacted. But what we did then was, when they were redacted, we went into ASIO and had a look at the unredacted version. So when we wrote the history, we wrote it with full access to the information. So any conclusion that we came to was with full access. If at some subsequent stage ASIO wanted to cut out half a sentence because it mentioned somebody's name or because it mentioned a technique, it didn't affect the conclusion that we had come to. So we went to the archives, we got what they've got, and then if they were redacted, we went to ASIO to have a look at the unredacted version.
Question here. Having perused the documents concerning this period, can you give us some indication of how much of a threat the CPA actually was?
So what kind of a threat was the Communist Party of Australia?
Well, the Communist Party was quite large after the Second World War, and it was stirring up trouble in the unions. It was really making a strong effort in the late 1940s to see if they could achieve their aims. I think from the late 1940s, probably even from the time of the Chifley government, which was trying to counter this. From the time of the Chifley government onwards, there's a continual decline in the size of the Communist Party. There's a twofold threat from the Communist Party. On one side is the threat from members of the Communist Party who might get into government positions where they pass information to the Soviets, espionage. The second one is the subversion, that is, trying to undermine Australia. There's no doubt that through the 1950s that the level of that threat continually declines, but I think that ASIO took the same sort of approach that any defence force takes, and that is to defend it, you know, take the worst case scenario and be prepared for it. So CPA was a bit of its own worst enemy, because every time people might be thinking, perhaps they're not a threat, somebody would get up and say, well, we've nothing else for it, but everybody needs to be shot or something, which would, yeah, so, you know, reinforce that view that they're a threat. But really, in terms of the threat, they were declining throughout the 1950s.
Second last question, right down the back there. Was there any problem getting access from the government in 2008 to the documents in the 1950s and 60s?
Well, no, just in 2008, I didn't
have any problem
to get those access.
How difficult was it to get access in 2008?
I've had access right through to now.
The decision by the government in 2008
to give you access? I think the government signed off on an official history. I don't think they knew what they were signing off on. I write official histories. I've got other official history projects, and the ANU put forward a tender, and I prepared the tender, and I said that I wouldn't do it unless I have full access. I can't write a history if you tell me little bits and pieces, and then hand on heart say what I've written is true. I must see the lot. And I laid down a series of conditions which went beyond the tender. And I also gave them a cost which was, I thought, large enough such that they wouldn't select me, because I had other jobs to do. They eventually phoned me up and said, we've got some bad news, you've got the job. But within that, I laid down that I could not do it without having full access to every record. And I explained that to the Director General, and the successive Director Generals have absolutely abided by that. And I think there's an element of trust there. That is, they trusted me that in telling this stuff to me, it wasn't going to get out on the street the next day. And that was, I think, because I have written several other official histories.
No, we've got to move on. We're going to go to Wayne, then we're going to go to Michael, then and then I'll ask a very brief question at the end. Yep. Yes.
I was wondering if there was any source where ASIO were still recruited from, for example,
Yes, yes, the source.
any particular area where ASIO was recruited from?
There's recruited because somebody knew somebody else. There's a bit of nepotism here, you know, people who are in there get their family members in, that sort of thing. Recruited from the services, very, very big. Recruited from the public service, recruited from the Commonwealth Investigation Service, and there was some reached into universities such as Michael Thwaites as well, and some people from a few people from overseas intelligence services who'd migrated to Australia. So it came from different areas, but there are not a huge number of people from universities in the first start instance.
You go from Malcolm, we go to Michael, yes?
Yes, there's been some coverage in the last couple of years about saying that the former Central Art Minister was a secretary of the Communist Party, based upon that. So, did you come across any?
Yes, I did.
Well, hang on just a second. There's a suggestion that the late Senator Arthur Geitzel was a. The Labor Senator was a member of the Communist Party. Did you come across any of that evidence?
Yes, I did.
And were there any other? From the left faction.
Yes, there were some others, and the names just escaped me at the moment, but there is no doubt that the ASIO records that I saw in the period of my volume that the records were indicating that Arthur Geitzel, as well as his brother Ray, were members of the Communist Party in the period that I'm dealing with.
And just finally, the most colourful figure, I guess, from this period in ASIO was Charles Spry. So what sort of guy is he?
I've spent quite a lot of space giving the Spry's background in the book. And then I spent quite a bit of time explaining what Charles Spry did. Charles Spry actually did, I think, a remarkable job of professionalising ASIO, getting it set up as a proper professional organisation, getting the government on side. He, as the top man, managed the Petrov defection. He tried to get legislative cover for ASIO, and in the period of my volume, I think Spry comes out as an outstanding head of an intelligence organisation. Now, there's no doubt that he had a bit of a fix about the Communist Party, and we've talked previously about the surveillance. From talking to the people who were in ASIO at the time, they all had a very high regard for Spry. I think I can jump through to the next volume just to say that that view about Spry's performance doesn't continue into the 1960s, when we've got the Vietnam protests, when Spry starts to get stuck into the drink a bit, and his relations with the government, especially after Menzies goes, deteriorates. But in the period that I'm dealing with, Spry comes out as an outstanding head of the intelligence organisation, with the weaknesses I've talked about of the fixation about surveillance with the Soviets, and also associated of the CPA, and also what I called an extravagant interpretation of the ASIO Act when it came to spoiling operations.
Professor Horner, thank you very much. Accurate to say that over many years, David Horne has made a terrific contribution to our understanding of our own history as a considered and rational historian dealing with the facts. And we've seen that tonight on the occasion of the publication of this book. And as I said, Janet Grundy's got some copies of the Flycatchers. But for tonight, I'd just like to say to Professor Horner, that was a great performance, and you've done very important work about a period of Australian society from the late 40s through to the early 60s, which was a very significant period where we faced real challenges. And from what I've read of your book and what I've seen tonight, you've considered all this in a very impassioned and reasonable manner. So well done, and no doubt you'll come back again in the future when something else comes out. But tonight, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks, sir. Thank you very much.